if I do not relax. But then in trying to relax, I just come off as a twat. Despite knowing that, I still try to relax. And though I smile all the while, I'm just wondering how long before I can leave. And when I do,
listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing. And I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
It's the Relativistic Gravity edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, where is outer space, laser-powered spaceships, LIGO and gravitational waves, black hole twins, political correctness and music from our prairie correspondent, who invented the internet and who owns the moon. Let's begin episode 335.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. For those of you who may not know, my voice is still recovering, but I am sure by the next show, you will be listening to my natural voice, but until then, Hal is returning to sub in for my voice. This week I thought I would start off with an homage to Yuri Gagarin, the first man in space, well, the first person in space as well. To say first man in space does kind of imply that a woman may have been there first, but alas, no. So, it was 55 years ago last week that humanity for the first time stripped the chains of terra firma and enjoyed the freedom and weightlessness of true space. Okay, to be fair, his trip consisted of one orbit lasting 108 minutes from launch to landing. He reached a top altitude of 169 kilometers, which to provide context, is the distance between Victoria and Chilliwack. Of course that makes me wonder, where is outer space? Is there a line or something? A little sign that you pass saying something like, "You are now leaving Earth's atmosphere. Please ensure your windows are completely sealed and we look forward to your return." Honestly, I sometimes get too much time to think. Well, as it turns out, there is no hard written in stone, written in air definition of outer space. As it turns out, it depends on who you ask as to where outer space starts. The US uses 80 kilometers or 50 miles as the point where, if you travel that far up, you earn the title astronaut. Technically, it's where you earn your astronaut badge for space travel from the US Department of Defense. NASA uses the distance of 122 kilometers as a demarcation point. It justifies that as the point that roughly marks the boundary where atmospheric drag becomes noticeable, thus beginning the process of switching from steering with thrusters to maneuvering with air surfaces. A very pragmatic approach. In 2009, scientists at the University of Calgary established a boundary at 118 kilometers or 73 miles, above Earth. The boundary represents the midpoint of a gradual transition between the relatively gentle wind of the Earth's atmosphere to the more violent flows of charged particles in space. That said, this is a midpoint of a zone that is tens of kilometers wide. The Kármán line, named after Theodore von Kármán and established by Fédération Aéronautique Internationale, which is the world governing body for air sports and aeronautics. They put outer space at about 100 kilometers, nice round number. The justification of this point is because a vehicle would have to travel faster than orbital velocity in order to derive sufficient aerodynamic lift from the atmosphere to support itself. That is, planes don't crash because they get enough lift from the air to keep them aloft, satellites don't crash because they are moving fast enough to, well, avoid hitting the Earth. What do I mean avoid hitting the Earth? Well, all objects in orbit are falling to the Earth, just lifting a ball off a table and letting it go, boom, it falls downward. However, if you threw the ball forward, it would still fall to the ground, but it would take longer because it is also moving forward. I am going to make up some numbers here, but check out the math on your own, the idea is sound. Okay, let's go, I drop my ball, it travels 2 feet downwards. I now throw the ball at a speed of 100 kilometers an hour, it still hits the Earth, but 100 feet away, now I double the speed, and it lands 200 feet away, let's multiply the speed, now it falls 2000 feet away, and at a certain point, the point it lands is actually in space itself. For an object to be in orbit simply means that the object is moving fast enough forward, relative to the Earth, that it is in a perpetual state of falling. And that is where those of you say, great, there you have it, at whatever distance an object begins to orbit the Earth, that is outer space. Sorry, but it doesn't work as neatly as it sounds. In theory, an object with sufficient velocity could orbit the planet a mile above the surface, as orbit is a function of speed and altitude, there is no hard point or distance, there is no altitude that, again in theory, that an object traveling at sufficient speed could not be said to be in orbit. Simply saying orbital distance does not work. Okay, maybe the UN has a hard line, they did pass the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, one might think in the bureaucratic obsession with verbiage that someone would have written a definition of where outer space started, but no, it seems the Kármán line is the default if not the technical definition of where outer space starts. Oh. And remember when I said jokingly that leaving Earth's atmosphere equaled entering outer space, how much wronger could I be? You see, our atmosphere goes a long way up, technically the exosphere, the upper part of Earth's atmosphere is between 700 to 70,000 kilometers, and the layer below that, the thermosphere, between 80 to 700 kilometers. So, oddly enough, it seems most of Earth's atmosphere, by area, is actually in outer space, however you judge it. You are listening to Radio Free Thinker on CITR 101.9 FM, a skeptical broadcast that reaches beyond the limits of outer space. And we're back. A proposal that has been making the rounds lately is to, wait for it, construct a laser-powered spaceship. Oh, yeah baby. The principle behind what is technically called photonic propulsion is basically the same as, or one might say the next step of solar sails. The idea of solar sails is that you string up a huge, sail, that will be pushed by the solar wind. This includes photons, very simple, relatively cheap, and very inefficient. Well, not to chemical rockets but to lasers. Yes, inefficient. You see, the sun puts out a lot of energy but it spreads it out, so no spot of space gets much, the inefficient part that is. Although the energy is free, the amount of actual thrust provided is negligible. Photonic propulsion, or laser drive, if I may invent the term, according to Google at least, takes an energy source concentrated into a highly focused beam, the laser beam, thus converting most of the energy put in, into thrust. To make this work, the idea is to put lasers into space, although I think in principle, the moon, or even Earth-based lasers could work. This laser would then focus on a pusher plate, or to keep our metaphors straight, our sail, which would experience orders of magnitude more thrust than it would get from the solar wind. This is how a spaceship could get to Mars in 3 days and Alpha Centauri in less than a couple of decades. Actually, the super fast space flight is actually a bonus or side story for the real news item, and that is a space-based super laser, or DSTAR, which stands for Directed Energy System for Targeting of Asteroids and Exploration. Yes, they dropped the E and used the R, in exploration to make a word, otherwise star becomes stay, which is Norwegian for stubborn, not a good name. The main aim of DSTAR, which is not as cool as saying super space laser but is also less Bond villainy. Anyway, DSTAR's main role is to shoot down the planet-killer asteroid that is coming sooner or later. Think of it as a fly swatter for meteorites. DSTAR is intended to be a solar-powered space station that, besides keeping the skies clear of nasties, could also be used to power a new generation of space exploration. If you had a laser array producing around 120 GHz of power, well, that could power a ship about 200 kilograms, think Pathfinder, to around 1.5% the speed of light, which sounds a little disappointing until you realize that this is 300 times faster than the current space speedster, Voyager 1. Of course, the problem is to build such a solar-powered laser array, you would need a station about 10 kilometers squared, which is not something NASA has the budget for anytime soon. That said, a test of this concept is planned where you build a 1 meter squared laser array and use it to power a tiny satellite. They are calling wafer sats, because it's a satellite on a wafer, efficient if not creative. Now, by wafer, they mean weighing less than a gram, and onto that they need to pack onto it power, steering, communications, sensors, etc. Well, you might think that fantasy tech, but none other than Stephen Hawking just joined Mike Zuckerberg, of Facebook fame, and Russian billionaire Yuri Milner to launch a project called Breakthrough Starshot. This is a $100-billion research and engineering program with the aim of seeking a proof of concept for using light beam to propel super lightweight nanocraft to 20% of light speed. This craft will have a camera, navigation instruments. In the article I read, they called it a GPS, but unless they meant galactic positioning system, I assume they were using a shorthand of sorts. That said, even they only expect the first launch to be in a couple of decades, so, maybe not fantasy tech, but definitely future tech. This is with the assumption that governments would not be investing in such speculative technology. Except, remember I said the main function of DSTAR is not space travel but asteroid destruction. That is something a government would invest in, and if we were actually under the threat of a collision, a Manhattan-type project would be launched on a global scale, and from which future tech could be invented, relatively speaking, overnight. That said, we also may need the collective destruction of the planet to even get the nations of the Earth to agree to the placement of, what did I call it earlier, oh yes, super space laser, or what some might call giant space laser capable of wiping out a city from space, what points away from Earth could be pointed at Earth and used as a weapon. But we humans would never do something like that. Well, we can hope for a planet-killer asteroid to smooth over these hesitations. Of course, laser power source is only one of the challenges facing these nanosats. In fact, one of the downsides to this being used to power spaceships is, well, sure, you can get to Mars in 3 days, but if you want to stop and smell the, sense, well, there is no way, yet, for this system to slow down the spacecraft, so, you get there quick, but it's also a short stay. As I said, promising, and we shall wait and see if we can get at least a drive-by view of our stellar neighbor. We will return after this break.
Ever had a hankering to ski the world-famous slopes of Whistler? Boy, do we have great news for you. Escape the city in one of Zipcar's many mountain-ready vehicles. Plus, get $30 back in free driving credit when you tweet a selfie on the slopes at Zipcar Vancouver. Zipcar, wheels when you want them.
You are listening to Radio Free Thinker, your relativistic quantum gravity wave-powered skeptical radio broadcast. And we're back. Okay, so we left off by saying that humanity witnessed its first gravitational waves when two black holes collided, and that in and of itself is marvelous, but there is an added twist that if you asked me 6 months ago, I would have called you nuts, crazy talk, could not possibly happen, laws of physics and the universe and all that. And then you, as in your humble host, discovers he is a complete dunce and know nothing, okay, a bit harsh, I know some things, but obviously not everything. Why the harsh words? Well, if Seem said colliding black holes were created by a singular solar mass, as in a single star created two black holes. Okay, yes, I can hear my many fans streaming to the ether, that such a thing is impossible, completely on board, my first thoughts as well, but apparently it is possible. Though, for those who may not be aware of the fate of supermassive solar masses, big stars, let me provide some background. First, one may ask, why does the Sun, which I have it on good authority is very heavy, not collapse under its own weight, in the same way that a balloon would collapse or flatten out if you put too much weight on it? Well, basically, if the center of the Sun pushed out, to continue with our balloon analogy, if the balloon started to collapse, you could just pump more air into it or you could heat up the air in the balloon, and that would push back on the weight, or let's now call it the force of gravity pushing down. Now, of course, there is no hose pumping more air into the Sun, but there is something going on at the center of the Sun that heats up the gases there. The first energy source is gravity itself, as the Sun is compressed at its core by gravity, via pressure and friction, it heats up, kind of in the same way your hands may heat up if you press hard and rub them together. This is enough energy to prevent somethings like the Earth or Jupiter, or to preface future segments, brown dwarfs, from collapsing, but the Sun is too heavy, that its mass, or the push of gravity down would outstrip this heated up energy. Fortunately for the Sun, at a certain point, the pressure and heat is great enough, fission starts, that is hydrogen atoms start slamming into each other with enough force, they combine to form helium, and extra energy is left over, the extra energy pushes back against gravity and the Sun reaches an equilibrium, for now. After several billion years, in our Sun's case, trillions of years for red dwarfs and only decades for blue hypergiants, well, the hydrogen fuel runs out, and gravity begins to win, and the star begins to collapse. At this point, when the Sun collapses enough that the center reaches new heights in temperature and pressure, the helium that the first round of fusion created, itself begins to fuse to usually form lithium or carbon, then you get oxygen, then silicon and eventually you end up with simple iron. I have simplified the element creation path that are created in normal stars, about 49 elements are created in stars. That said, when iron is the main fuel, well, the jig is up, until now, all the fusion reaction has created new elements and a little extra energy, when we hit iron, to make it a bigger element via fusion requires added energy, that is, it not only does not create more energy, to help beat back the barbarians of gravity, it removes energy, weakening the defenses, which means that at this point, the star can no longer hold off the pressures of gravity and it collapses. If a star is lighter than one solar mass, or the mass of our Sun, it will basically stop contracting and the fusion engine will stop and it will just cool off like an ember, white, to red, to orange to, well, black. For those bigger than 8 solar masses, you have another energy source, that is the power of neutrons. These start to collapse until they reach the size of a large city, about a 10 to 15 kilometers wide. They are supported against further collapse by quantum degeneracy pressure due to the phenomenon described by the Pauli exclusion principle. Put another way, for the sake of our conversation. Blah, blah, blah science, yes, these also will be hot for some time, but eventually they cool off to become embers, like our sun. If a star has a solar mass greater than 15, well, even the power of neutrons will not stop the pressure gravity, these essentially collapse into a singularity, which, when exposed into a supernova, which beyond creating 64 elements, also can create a remnant, usually a neutron star, with much of the star's mass blown into space, a stable neutron star is left behind. Okay, so you may have noticed that all of this involves a singular, a sun, a supernova, a black hole, one star, one event, or so I thought. It seems that if a star is rotating fast enough, it actually forms a barbell shape, that is one star with two centers of mass, connected by a filament, so it's not a binary star, or so I am told. Each bar had enough mass to form its own black hole, and because they were about the same time of life, it seemed to collapse at the same time, or something. Yes, the details are a tad fuzzy, can I say fuzzy when I mean, beyond my understanding, yes, fuzzy sounds better. So, the details are fuzzy, it seems a single star can, if spinning fast enough, create two black holes, of course because of their proximity to each other, a family reunion, if you like, was inevitable, and thus out Lord High Master, Carl Sagan in his infinite wisdom, provided this proof of gravitational waves and by proxy the theory of relativity, all praise Sagan. Okay, but that is only part of the holy shite, this is a big aspect of this discovery. When we look at the universe we see only one thing, photons, light, in all its forms, but it is all photons. To bring this home, our view of the universe is like a person having only one sense, sight, which, don't get me wrong, is great, but we are deaf, can't taste, smell or any other sense, our understanding of the world is very limited. And, so far, that is our perception of the universe. We are trying to add a neutrino sense, with limited success, but if we can see gravitational waves, that would be like a whole new way to see the universe, and see it in ways that would exponentially improve our understanding of the cosmos. For example, we know of dark matter, but we can only see it indirectly via its gravitational effects on optical objects, i.e. stars and stuff. The only thing we know for sure about dark matter is it has gravity. A gravity wave observatory would allow us for the first time to see dark matter directly, and that could be a game changer in our understanding of the universe. Okay, we are taking another quick break so we can retool our skeptical minds for a completely different mindset. We will be back after this break.
On April 23rd at 8:30 p.m., Vivo Media Arts presents Destroy Vancouver at Vivo, 2625 Caslow Street. Featuring Anne F. Jacques, Alex Moskos, Alexander Spence, Emma Hendricks and Julie Gendron, Martin Messier, Victor Maison Gardeki. Destroy Vancouver is an improvised music series curated by Lisa Ferrari and John Brennan.
You are listening to Radio Free Thinker on CITR 101.9 FM, a skeptical broadcast that reaches beyond the limits of outer space. And we're back. A proposal that has been making the rounds lately is to, wait for it, construct a laser-powered spaceship. Oh, yeah baby. The principle behind what is technically called photonic propulsion, is basically the same as, or one might say the next step of solar sails. The idea of solar sails is that you string up a huge, sail, that will be pushed by the solar wind. This includes photons, very simple, relatively cheap, and very inefficient, well, not to chemical rockets but to lasers, Yes, inefficient. You see, the sun puts out a lot of energy, but it spreads it out, so no spot of space gets much, the inefficient part that is. Although the energy is free, the amount of actual thrust provided is negligible. Photonic propulsion, or laser drive, if I may invent the term, according to Google at least, takes an energy source concentrated into a highly focused beam, the laser beam, thus converting most of the energy put in, into thrust. To make this work, the idea is to put lasers into space, although I think in principle, the moon or even Earth-based lasers could work. This laser would then focus on a pusher plate, or to keep our metaphors straight, our sail, which would experience orders of magnitude more thrust than it would get from the solar wind. This is how a spaceship could get to Mars in 3 days and Alpha Centauri in less than a couple of decades. Actually, the super-fast space flight is actually a bonus or side story for the real news item, and that is a space-based super laser, or DSTAR, which stands for Directed Energy System for Targeting of Asteroids and Exploration. Yes, they dropped the E and used the R, in exploration to make a word, otherwise STAR becomes STE, which is Norwegian for stubborn, not a good name. The main aim of DSTAR, which is not as cool as saying super space laser but is also less Bond villainy. Anyway, DSTAR's main role is to shoot down the planet-killer asteroid that is coming sooner or later. Think of it as a fly swatter for meteorites. DSTAR is intended to be a solar-powered space station that, besides keeping the skies clear of nasties, could also be used to power a new generation of space exploration. If you had a laser array producing around 120 GHz of power, well, that could power a ship about 200 kilograms, think Pathfinder, to around 1.5% the speed of light, which sounds a little disappointing until you realize that this is 300 times faster than the current space speedster, Voyager 1. Of course, the problem is to build such a solar-powered laser array, you would need a station about 10 kilometers squared, which is not something NASA has the budget for anytime soon. That said, a test of this concept is planned where you build a 1 meter squared laser array and use it to power a tiny satellite. They are calling wafer sats, because it's a satellite on a wafer, efficient if not creative. Now, by wafer, they mean weighing less than a gram, and onto that they need to pack onto it power, steering, communications, sensors, etc. Well, you might think that fantasy tech, but none other than Stephen Hawking just joined Mike Zuckerberg, of Facebook fame, and Russian billionaire Yuri Milner to launch a project called Breakthrough Starshot. This is a $100 billion research and engineering program with the aim of seeking a proof of concept for using light beam to propel super lightweight nanocraft to 20% of light speed. This craft will have a camera, navigation instruments. In the article I read, they called it a GPS, but unless they meant galactic positioning system, I assume they were using a shorthand of sorts. That said, even they only expect the first launch to be in a couple of decades, so, maybe not fantasy tech, but definitely future tech. This is with the assumption that governments would not be investing in such speculative technology. Except, remember I said the main function of DSTAR is not space travel but asteroid destruction. That is something a government would invest in, and if we were actually under the threat of a collision, a Manhattan-type project would be launched on a global scale, and from which future tech could be invented, relatively speaking, overnight. That said, we also may need the collective destruction of the planet to even get the nations of the Earth to agree to the placement of, what did I call it earlier, oh yes, super space laser, or what some might call giant space laser capable of wiping out a city from space, what points away from Earth could be pointed at Earth and used as a weapon. But we humans would never do something like that. Well, we can hope for a planet-killer asteroid to smooth over these hesitations. Of course, laser power source is only one of the challenges facing these nanosats. In fact, one of the downsides to this being used to power spaceships is, well, sure, you can get to Mars in 3 days, but if you want to stop and smell the, sands, well, there is no way, yet, for this system to slow down the spacecraft, so, You get there quick, but it's also a short stay. As I said, promising, and we shall wait and see if we can get at least a drive-by view of our stellar neighbor. Okay, next we are going to have a word from our prairie correspondent about social censorship. Let's listen in.
The last couple of days there's been a firestorm over some lyrics of two songs that were aired on a program on City FM in Winnipeg called Wheeler in the Morning. The names of the two were like Transcona Girls and North End Boys. So much so, like, there's been enough complaints, apparently, anyway, that the Canadian Broadcasting Standards has asked Rogers to turn over the recordings to them. Now, I'd say the lyrics to these songs are derogatory, and that's stating the obvious. This self-regulatory organization that I referred to earlier is in response to these complaints, according to the article in the CBC website, stating that the lyrics were aggressive and abusive to women, to which I would also add to the men, as in the latter offering. These songs and the animated images, and the images are animated, they don't have real people, so it's like looking at cartoons, have been removed from the broadcasting sites, but they're still available on YouTube. Apparently, the CBSC has no jurisdiction over the internet. And because of this, Mr. Wheeler has been suspended, and the radio station has apologized. And until Rogers releases the tapes to the council, that's the extent of the reaction so far. Now, I'm going to read the part that kind of lets you know what the process is. Once the CBSC receives the radio recordings, and if complaints are not satisfied by Rogers Media's actions, the CBSC can assemble a six-person panel. And these includes three members of the public and three industry reps to review the broadcast and determine whether it violates its code of ethics. There is a code that's been adopted by the Canadian Association of Broadcasters and is validated by the CRTC. The CBSC is not able to fine Rogers Media. However, if the company is found in violation of the code of ethics three times, they can be kicked out of the CBSC, which could put their CRTC broadcasting license at risk. And Rogers Media has 15 days to respond to the complaints. Okay, that sounds like a big deal to me. Everybody has their hackles up, and they're going to do something. Or not. Now, after listening to these songs, and I had to go and listen to them, I listened to them on YouTube, and I was curious, and, you know, it's that kind of thing. Well, I don't like that kind of thing, but I have to know what's going on, or I can't say anything about it, so I'm going to have to listen. I'm just going to have to do it. So I sacrificed. And I said to myself, after this, don't you find it rather hypocritical, like, that this is even happening? And my outer self says, yeah, hypocritical, to say the least. Think about a certain type of music out there, like rap and rock videos. Listen to the lyrics. Are they any different than those aired on City FM? There is a difference, though, and these are mega influential commodities producing billions for their providers and creative entities. Is anyone complaining? Is anything being done? Nope. And just why is that? Why is it because this case involves a more vulnerable person / station, you know, little bitty Winnipeg. I can't even remember the guy's name, except it ends, it's Wheeler, and City FM, you know, rings no bells for most people. Or is it because it hits closer to home? Is this a case of NIMBYism? As I said earlier, these lyrics to these two songs are derogatory to both men and women, but so are thousands of other songs. Much more listened to, given much more airtime, much more play than these, and performed by some very famous artists. What about them? Why? Why this guy? Just listen to some of the lyrics of this stuff that passes as entertainment. So, the point of I'm trying to get across is I say either you go after the big boys and girls to respect others, or you leave the little guy alone. Because if you don't find them both unacceptable, then nobody is. Just saying.
Okay, now that you heard the controversy, let's listen to the songs themselves and you can judge for yourself.
Following may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
Well, living in the North End ain't that good. You have to learn to fight when you grow up in the hood. I never learned how, but I ran real good. Thank God I'm a North End boy. Well, there's holes in the wall and bloodstained red. I try to fall asleep, but I got no bed. I go outside, try not to end up dead. Thank God I'm a North End boy. Well, it's all about the hoes and it's all about the honeys. Take a sucker out when he tries to get funny. Life ain't nothing but bitches and money. Thank God I'm a North End boy. Well, I roll around town in my 86 LeBaron. I go and get a 2-6 and I won't be sharing. Then I get high so I won't be caring. Thank God I'm a North End boy. Well, I got no worries cause I'm real high. I got a big woman weighs 305. I don't have to work cause I collect EI. Thank God I'm a North End boy. Well, it's all about the hoes and it's all about the honeys. Take a sucker out when he tries to get funny. Life ain't nothing but bitches and money. Thank God I'm a North End boy. Thank God I'm a North End boy.
Well, Elmwood girls are tough. They really give me quite a scare. Charleswood girls with the way they shop, yeah, they spend like they don't care. And the North End daughters really like to stab you and steal your bike. And the Wolseley girls with their hairy pits, they keep the girlfriends warm at night.
I wish they all could be dressed Kona. I wish they
shit canned. I dig the leopard print and the shoulder pads and the hair around their clams. They've been passed around this great big town and they just don't seem to care. Which is bad for me cause it hurts when I pee, but she always goes back down.
I wish they be dressed Kona. I wish they all could be dressed Kona. I wish they all could be dressed Kona.
Listening to Radio Free Thinker, your censorship-free radio broadcast. Let's listen to some web wisdom from today I found out about who invented the internet.
Who actually invented the internet? While the World Wide Web was initially invented by one person, the genesis of the internet itself was a group effort by numerous individuals. Sometimes they were working in concerts, and at other times they were working independently. Its birth takes us back to the extremely competitive technological contest between the US and the USSR during the Cold War. The Soviet Union sent the satellite Sputnik 1 into space on October 4, 1957. Partially in response, the American government created, in 1958, the Advanced Research Projects Agency, known today as DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. The agency's specific mission was to prevent technological surprises like the launch of Sputnik, which signaled that the Soviets had beaten the US into space. The mission statement has evolved over time. Today, DARPA's mission is still to prevent technological surprise to the US, but also to create technological surprise for our enemies. To coordinate such efforts, a rapid way to exchange data between various universities and laboratories was needed. This brings us to JCR Licklider, who is largely responsible for the theoretical basis of the Internet, an intergalactic computer network. His idea was to create a network where different computer systems would be interconnected to one another to quickly exchange data rather than have individual systems set up, each one connecting to some other individual system. He thought up the idea after having to deal with three separate systems connected to computers in Santa Monica, the University of California, Berkeley, and a system at MIT. Quote, "For each of these three terminals, I had three different sets of user commands. So if I was talking online with someone at SDC and I wanted to talk with someone I knew at Berkeley or MIT about this, I had to get up from the SDC terminal to go over and log into the other terminal and get in touch with them. I said, oh man, it's obvious what to do. If you have these three terminals, there ought to be one terminal that goes anywhere you want to go where you have interactive computing. That idea is the ARPANET." So yes, the idea for the Internet as we know it partially came about because of the seemingly universal human desire to not have to get up and move to another location. With the threat of a nuclear war, it was necessary to decentralize such a system, so that even if one node was destroyed, there would still be communication between all the other computers. The American engineer Paul Barron provided the solution to this issue. He designed a decentralized network that also used packet switching as a means for sending and receiving data. Many others also contributed to the development of an efficient packet switching system, including Leonard Kleinrock and Donald Davies. If you're not familiar with packet switching, it is basically just a method of breaking down all transmitted data, regardless of content, type, or structure, into suitably sized blocks called packets. So, for instance, if you wanted to access a large file from another system, when you attempted to download it, rather than the entire file being sent in one stream, which would require a constant connection for the duration of the download, it would get broken down into small packets of data, with each packet being individually sent, perhaps taking different paths through the network. The system that downloads the file would then reassemble the packets back into the original full file. The aforementioned platform by Licklider, ARPANET, was based on these ideas and was the principal precursor to the Internet as we think of it today. It was installed and operated for the first time in 1969 with four nodes, which were located at the University of California at Santa Barbara, the University of California at Los Angeles, SRI at Stanford University, and the University of Utah. The first use of the network took place on August 29, 1969 at 10:30 p.m. and was a communication between UCLA and Stanford Research Institute. As recounted by the aforementioned Leonard Kleinrock, this momentous communique went like this. Quote, "We set up a telephone connection between us and the guys at SRI. We typed the letter L, and we asked on the phone, 'Do you see the letter L?' 'Yes, we see the letter L,' came the response. We typed O, and we asked, 'Do you see the O?' 'Yes, we see the O.' Then we typed the G, and the system crashed. Yet, a revolution has begun." By 1972, the number of computers that were connected to ARPANET had reached 23, and it was at this time that the term electronic mail, email, was first used, when a computer scientist named Ray Tomlinson implemented an email system in ARPANET using the at symbol to differentiate the sender's name and the network name in the email address. Alongside these developments, engineers created more networks, which used different protocols such as X25 and UUCP. The original protocol for communication used by the ARPANET was the NCP, Network Control Protocol. The need for a protocol that would unite all the many networks was needed. In 1974, after many failed attempts, a paper published by Vint Cerf and Bob Kahn, known as the Fathers of the Internet, resulted in the protocol TCP, Transmission Control Protocol, which by 1978 would become TCP/IP, with the IP standing for Internet Protocol. At a high level, TCP/IP is essentially just a relatively efficient system for making sure the packets of data are sent and ultimately received where they need to go, and in turn assembled in the proper order so that the downloaded data mirrors the original file. So, for instance, if a packet is lost in transmission, TCP is the system that detects this and makes sure the missing packets get resent and are successfully received. Developers of applications can then use this system without having to worry about exactly how the underlying network communication works. On January 1, 1983, Flag Day TCP/IP would become the exclusive communication protocol for ARPANET. Also in 1983, Paul Mokopetris proposed a distributed database of internet name and address pairs, now known as the Domain Name System, DNS. This is essentially a distributed phone book, linking a domain's name to its IP address, allowing you to type something in, like todayifoundout.com, instead of the IP address of the website. The distributed version of this system allowed for a decentralized approach to this phone book. Now, this brings us to 1989, when Tim Berners-Lee of CERN, the European Organization for Nuclear Research, developed a system for distributing information on the internet and named it the World Wide Web. What made this system unique from existing systems of the day was the marriage of the hypertext system, linked pages, with the internet, particularly the marriage of one-directional links that didn't require any action by the owner of the destination page to make it work, as with bidirectional hypertext systems of the day. It also provided for relatively simple implementations of web servers and web browsers, and was a completely open platform, making it so anyone could contribute and develop their own such systems without paying any royalties. In the process of doing all of this, Berners-Lee developed the URL format, Hypertext Markup Language, HTML, and the Hypertext Transfer Protocol, HTTP. Around this same time, one of the most popular alternatives to the web, the Gopher system, announced it would no longer be free to use, effectively killing it, with many switching to the World Wide Web. Today, the web is so popular that many people often think of it as the internet, even though this isn't the case at all. Also, around the time that the World Wide Web was being created, the restrictions on commercial use of the internet were gradually being removed, which was another key element in the ultimate success of this network. Next up, in 1993, Marc Andreessen led a team that developed a browser for the World Wide Web named Mosaic. This was a graphical browser developed via funding through a US government initiative. Specifically, this was the High Performance Computing and Communications Act of 1991. This act was partially what Al Gore was referring to when he said that he took the initiative in creating the internet. All political rhetoric aside, and there was much to be had on both sides concerning this statement, as one of the fathers of the internet, Vincent Cerf, said, "The internet would not be where it is in the United States without the strong support given to it and related research areas by the Vice President, Al Gore, in his current role and his earlier role as senator. As far back as the 1970s, Congressman Gore promoted the idea of high-speed telecommunications as an engine for both economic growth and the improvement of our own educational system. He was the first elected official to grasp the potential of computer communications to have a broader impact than just improving the conduct of science and scholarship. His initiatives led directly to the commercialization of the internet. So he really does deserve credit. As for Mosaic, it was not the first web browser, as you'll sometimes read, simply one of the most successful until Netscape came around, which was developed by many of those who previously worked on Mosaic. The first ever web browser, called World Wide Web, was created by Berners-Lee. This browser had a nice graphical user interface, allowed for multiple fonts and font sizes, allowed for downloading and displaying images, sounds, animations, movies, etc., and had the ability to let users users edit the web pages being viewed in order to promote collaboration of information. However, this browser only ran on NextStep's operating system, which most people didn't have because of the extremely high cost of these systems. The company was owned by Steve Jobs, so you can imagine the cost bloat. In order to provide a browser anyone could use, the next browser Berners-Lee developed was much simpler, and thus versions of it could be quickly developed to run on just about any computer, for the most part, regardless of the processing power or operating system. It was a bare-bones, inline browser, command-line text only, which didn't have most of the features of the original browser. Mosaic essentially reintroduced some of the nicer features found in Berners-Lee's original browser, giving people a graphic interface to work with. It also included the ability to view web pages with inline images, instead of in separate windows as other browsers did at the time, but what really distinguished it from other graphical browsers was that it was easy for everyday users to install and use. The creators also offered 24-hour phone support to help people get it set up and working on their respective systems, and the rest, as they say, is history.
We end the show with comments from Vsauce about who owns the moon. Let's listen in.
Hey, Vsauce, Michael here. Gregory W. Nimitz registered some land containing $492 quintillion dollars worth of platinum. The land was right here. Well, over here. An asteroid named 433 Eros. Not a single sovereign nation on Earth recognizes human claims to extraterrestrial real estate, but he did it anyway. And then, less than a year later, NASA landed a probe on the asteroid. They called it the first asteroid we had ever landed a probe on. Nimitz called it parking space number 29 and promptly sent NASA a $20 parking ticket. But so far, NASA and the U.S. Attorney General have dismissed the fine, saying that his claim to own the asteroid is without legal merit. But why? Plenty of organizations exist that will gladly take your money in return for land on the moon, Venus, Mars. And if you had enough money to go to the moon, nothing is legally stopping you from moving there, building a house with a significant other, having some kids, and turning your moon house into a moon home. It wouldn't be trespassing or squatting or stealing. The 1979 Moon Treaty says that no one can own any part of outer space ever. But only 11 states have signed it. However, 129 nations have signed and/or ratified the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, which says that outer space is not subject to national appropriation. It says nothing about a private individual or a company owning part of outer space. But without the recognition and support of at least one sovereign nation, what does ownership really mean? I mean, I can claim anything I want. I can claim to own Prospect Park in Brooklyn. But just saying that I do, or even moving there and living in Prospect Park, wouldn't entitle me to the rights that usually go along with ownership, unless someone with a bunch of power agreed that I owned it and could enforce that ownership and keep others from claiming to also own it. In the past, explorers had few qualms about claiming to own land, even if other humans were already there, because they had power on their side, namely plenty of guns, germs, and steel. To paraphrase con artist Canada Bill Jones, you know what beats four aces? A gun. Or as Loblob pointed out, McDonald's actually does serve breakfast after 10:30 if you have a gun. If you claimed some land on the moon as your own and moved in, would you also have to hire your own lunar police and cislunar military to defend it and to keep others from challenging your claim? Pretty much. That's kind of the problem. Currently, it is risky for individuals or corporations to claim and use extraterrestrial territory because the Outer Space Treaty says that outer space is the common heritage of mankind. It belongs to all of us, and only to all of us. Many interpretations of the Outer Space Treaty predict that powerful things like nations would be reluctant to come to your defense should someone else want to move in or cause trouble or dispute your extraterrestrial claim. Maybe you could get a sovereign nation to weigh in on your behalf by declaring universal jurisdiction, but that would need to be for an incredibly terrible, heinous crime, a crime against all of humanity, not just a dispute over a few space rocks. Catherine Dolderina from the Institute of Air and Space Law at McGill University suggests that considering outer space the common heritage of mankind has slowed space exploration. You see, the Outer Space Treaty was based on the Antarctic Treaty, which says that the entire continent shall never become the scene or object of international discord. Discord is not a good thing, but without an incentive to profit from it, not much has happened there, as opposed to the Arctic, where a resource boom is currently underway. If people felt safer appropriating and taking advantage of space, of celestial bodies, if technological development was more incentivized, would we already have orbiting tourist attractions and lunar hotels? Maybe. But here is what you can currently own in outer space. Stuff you put there and, to a certain extent, orbits. The Outer Space Treaty says that the stuff we left on the moon, anything put into space, remains property of the original owner forever. Orbits around Earth are temporarily granted by the International Telecommunication Union, a UN agency, but they don't work like typical real estate on Earth. When a group of equatorial nations attempted to claim orbits above their land boundaries without planning on putting satellites there, their claim was largely ignored. So you not only need to ask the UN for an orbit and get permission, you also need to use it and fill it. It's a little disappointing that we don't know how lunar real estate works, or if it will, but it's exciting to know that we, within our lifetimes, might have a chance to be part of the solution, a unique generation not visiting space for the first time, but homesteading it for the first time. Here's another unresolved space law quandary. If an alien landed in your backyard, intelligent life from beyond Earth, and you shot it with a gun, dressed it, and then cooked up you and your family some alien meat fajitas, would that be hunting or murder? We literally don't know. On Earth, we have human rights, but there are no alien rights. Maybe it would fall under the category of cultural vandalism, an act that's not necessarily illegal, but is a giant bummer to the rest of humanity. This has happened before, not with aliens, but with paintings. In 2003, the Chapman brothers purchased one of the few remaining sets of Goya's fantastic Disasters of War. Instead of displaying the works for the public, they defaced them by drawing clown and puppy heads on the people. They called the work insult to injury. In protest, a man threw red paint on Jake Chapman when he appeared at Modern Art Oxford, but at the end of the day, what the Chapman brothers did wasn't illegal. They owned the paintings. Vandalizing the moon or killing a peaceful alien aren't illegal acts, but just like defacing historical paintings, they seem wrong on some deeper level, especially since, because in most museums, you usually can't even touch the paintings. But who was the first person to touch the moon with their bare hands? I mean, the guys who walked around on the moon wore spacesuits. They had material in between their skin and the moon. Well, to be sure, you already have the moon in your hands. Well, little moons. Lunula, the crescent-shaped area at the base of your fingernail where tissue is thicker and the red vascular structures underneath are more hidden, making it white. And to be even more sure, at the quantum level, touch is problematic. As I've covered before, atomically speaking, matter never really contacts other matter in the conventional sense. You can't truly touch anything. Minute physics called it interaction over a short distance. With that in mind, NASA says that Terry Slezik was the first person to touch the moon with his bare hands. He was a technician in quarantine who accidentally got lunar soil smeared all over his hand while removing film magazines from the astronauts' cameras. But when Armstrong and Aldrin returned to the lunar module,